8:04 on a Monday. Happy Monday, everybody. Halford Bruff, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Bruff of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer. Today, three dealerships to serve you better. North Shore Acura, Acura of Langley, and Burrard Acura on Terminal Avenue. Hours one and two of the program are in the books. You can download them now. Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Hour three, we are currently underway. Mark Spector from Sportsnet is going to join us in just a moment here. Hour three of the program is brought to you by Campbell & Pound Real Estate Appraisers. Trust the expertise of Campbell & Pound. Visit campbell-pound.com today. So your first round Stanley Cup playoff schedule works actually kind of well for the Calgary Flames. They'll get an extra day of rest after going late last night into overtime. The Battle of Alberta begins on Wednesday. So your combos are going to be Rangers-Carolina and then the Battle of Alberta. Those will all be played on the same nights, except for a couple wrinkles in the schedule. The other ones, of course, are going to be Tampa Bay-Florida, the Battle of Florida, and then St. Louis and Colorado. But the Battle of Alberta is what we're focused on here. And who better than to get the guy who wrote the book on the Battle of Alberta? Joining us now, Mark Spector from Sportsnet here on the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. Morning, Spec. How are you?
Good, boys. What's going on out there?
Not much. We want to know how excited you are, again, as the author of the guy that wrote the book on the Battle of Alberta, that 31 years later, we finally got the latest installment.
Yeah, it has been a little bit too long. Hey? I mean, think about that. Basically, everybody who's not 40 in Alberta really has no memory of you know, what it was like when Edmonton and Calgary played a playoff series. That's a, you know, that's a generation and a bit. So, you know, it'll never be as violent as it was in the old days. They probably won't need as many stretchers, but it still should be a ton of fun and really, you know, just a chapter that today's young fan who hasn't witnessed a lot of success in either of these towns is going to get to experience.
Do you agree with the with Las Vegas and the sports book that the Flames should be the favorites in this series?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're the first place team. You know, they have, I think everybody would say, better goaltending. You know, they're a bigger team. So, yeah, I would think they're the favorites in this team. I would likely pick them to win.
Draisaitl is going to be such a big factor for Edmonton, whether or not he's going to be healthy. What do you know about his health status going forward?
Almost nothing, other than the fact that he did play 22 minutes in Game 7. And as the game wore on, his skating got better. He started out limping around out there, and by the end of the second period, he was moving all right. So that, I guess what that tells me is it's not a catastrophic injury, right? It's not a high ankle sprain, you know, that no one with those that kind of injury gives you 22 minutes in a Game 7. So I think what we could say about Draisaitl is he's, you know, I'm sure he's a little sore, and he's not going to be at completely 100%, but you know what? It looks to me like he can give you most of what he is, and that's good news. The question might be also asked about Tanev. He's a pretty important defenseman in Calgary who missed their Game 7 altogether down there last night. So, you know, everyone gets an injury or two, and if you can't figure it out, you can't go on, right?
There was the great quote from your book from Tim Hunter, then with the Calgary Flames, of course. He said, "I hated every single guy in the Oilers because they all hated me." And we've talked about the anticipation for a series and then the things that have to happen within to really kick it off. And I look at this, I'm saying, so you've got the natural rivalry, interprovincial. You've got two teams that have some recent history of not liking one another. But the real important thing is you've got the right characters to mix it up to where everything looks as though the table has already been set for this to be. As you said, nothing's ever going to be as violent and as ugly as it was back in the 80s and 90s. But for the modern game and the way the modern game is played, they've got the right recipe here, I feel, for this thing to be a powder keg.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you hope so, right? Like, you want some extracurricular. You want some antagonism. You want, you know, some guys got to put the black hat on in this series, right? Mm-hmm. Can't have a bunch of, you know, what you won't have, I mean, it's playoffs, so you don't see the old NHLPA deal where they're all sitting around a warm-up chatting each other up from other teams because they golf in the summer. You won't get that.
Right.
You know, what you hope is that, you know, the guy that stirs the drink in this thing is Matt Tkachuk in Calgary. And you hope that he takes that, you know, he gets in there and starts standing over Mike Smith in the Oilers net and, you know, whacking at a late rebound. And then you'd say, okay, where's Zach Cassian? Is he coming in to do something about this? And you need those guys. Edmonton is not a particularly antagonistic team, right? They had, you know, Brendan Lemieux didn't have someone to match up to in the last series.
Right.
He's real good at stirring the pot. And I'll say this to you, you know, Edmonton needs more guys like that. They haven't had one for a long time. So the Battle of Alberta tends to, I remember Craig McTavish said to me once, he said, everybody, when Edmonton played Calgary back in the day, and to a lesser extent now, he said, everybody had to go out of character. We couldn't just be the guy we were in the regular season. If it came to your, in the regular season, he said, I didn't have to fight anybody. But in the Battle of Alberta, I had to stand up for myself because the other guys were busy standing up for themselves. So we get a little bit of that, and we'll have a whole bunch of fun for the next 2 weeks.
I have such fond memories of the Battle of Alberta as a kid because I was just starting to watch hockey. 83, 84, the Oilers won it, and they went on to win the Stanley Cup. 1986, the Flames won in Game 7 on the Steve Smith own goal. 1988, the Oilers swept the Flames and went on to win the Stanley Cup. The only time the Battle of Alberta occurred and none of the teams went on to win the Stanley Cup was in 1991 when the Oilers won it in Game 7. So five series, four Oilers wins, and the 86 one was a very special deciding goal. What are some of your favorite memories of the Battle of Alberta?
Well, a lot of them, to be honest, occurred off the ice. It was the... You know, I mean, you got to put it into context. The Edmonton Oilers were the best team in the world back then, and the Calgary Flames were like, or in the National Hockey League, and the Calgary Flames were like 2, 3, or 4 that whole time. So, the level of hockey was, I mean, they're both decent teams now, but they're not the 1 and 2 or 1 and 3 in the National Hockey League by anyone's estimation. The level of hockey was so great. Edmonton, Calgary had to figure out how to take something away from Edmonton. Calgary should have won more than one cup in those days, but they didn't because of the Oilers explicitly. So there was a real hatred because the Oilers really stood in the way of something for Calgary. And you know what? For every Flame back then, there was just an incrementally better Oiler. You know, Gretzky was better than Kent Nilsson, and Coffey was better than McInnes, and Fuhr, Vernon was good, but Fuhr was better, right? So there's no doubt who the little brother was in that matchup. It's not like that anymore, but it was back then. And when you play each other all the time, it just got worse and worse and worse and more violent, and Marty McSorley spearing Mike Bullard in the you-know-whats, and Mark Messier's elbowing guys into the, concussion protocol, which they didn't have back then, right? You won't get that, but I think what you do get is two teams playing for the same thing here. What you want, and I include Vancouver in this, what you want is a group of teams out here that have to get through each other to get somewhere, and that's where we're at here in Alberta, and I'm assuming the Canucks are going to join in on this thing pretty soon.
We're speaking to Mark Spector, author of The Battle of Alberta, also Sportsnet.ca. You see him on the broadcast as well. Spec, someone just texted this in, and good symmetry because I was going to ask you about it, the officiating in this series. That, to me, is when we're looking at this and saying, how is this going to play out? And we talk about antagonizing and post-scrum, post-whistle scrums and all that. I really hope that the referees can look at this series and understand that there's a feud, there's a rivalry, it's going to be ugly, and they don't ruin it by picking guys out of scrums, or I've seen a lot of 10-minute misconducts from scrums where it's like, let's just let these guys cool off, and they just toss them. That, to me, is game management. I understand that, but at the same time, you've got to let a rivalry like this breathe. I feel like the sport almost deserves it, that you have to kind of let them push the boundaries because – it is a rivalry, and we don't get it that often. 31 years between Battle of Alberta's, you want this one to have a little bit of that fire, maybe even more than a little
bit. Yeah, for sure. I mean, the question becomes a little bit, does Edmonton want in on what you just described?
Sure.
Calgary's bigger, right? They got that Zadorov and Good Brownson pair. Edmonton doesn't have a pair like that. They've got, you know, big Milan Lucic. They got Richie. They got better size and bigger, rougher players on that team that Edmonton has. Edmonton's got a couple tough guys, but not as many. So, but in terms of the officiating, I couldn't, you know, I absolutely couldn't agree more. We need this, you know, you want this series to, you want the refs to allow some bad blood to get flowing here. You can't play the game the way the game you're just talking about and that all of our listeners here want to see. It can't be played by players who think, oh my God, if I do one wrong, one shove and I'm going in the penalty
box, right? Yep.
You can't have that. And I, you know, the officials are, they're just like us. They're hockey people. They're hockey fans. They want to see a bunch of stuff too, but they got to keep this thing on the rails as well, right? They got bosses too. So, you know, you'll get the best officials. You'll get the best officials. And I knowing a lot of these referees over the years that I've been around the league, I guess I would just say to you, they love that kind of hockey too. But it's on them to make sure that no one gets killed out there. So they got to kind of walk a bit of a line. Let's hope they figure out how to walk it the right way.
Speck, we got to talk about Connor McDavid and his performance in Game 6 and 7 against the LA Kings. Where does that – I mean, you've seen some pretty good Oilers teams and some pretty good Oilers players over the years. Where does that performance rank in all-time lore?
Well, that's a good question. There was a game back in the 80s that Mark Messier played in Chicago that always stands out. He walked into the – they needed a win really bad in the old Chicago Stadium. He went in and just dominated the game. And that came up, you know, in Game 6, particularly for McDavid. I mean, the last two games all go together. They went in L.A., they won Game 6. He had 3 points in a 4-2 win. They came home, they won 2-0. He had 2 points in a 2-0 win. I think Game 6 might have been the finest game he's played in the National Hockey League. He got 3 points. He didn't get 6 or 7. But listen, you guys, the whole thing out here, like that 2-0 win in Game 7, guys, the Oilers don't beat anybody 2-0.
Right.
And have a 29-save shutout in which Mike Smith had, was good, but didn't have to be great. Like, that's not the Oilers, right? They beat you 5-4 if they beat you at all. And I think we all know that over the last 25 years, that's been a crappy strategy because they lose more 5-4 games than they win. So what's going on here is McDavid is playing the game like he's gone full Sid Crosby in terms of his effort defensively. Maybe he's not as good as Sid in his own zone yet, but I'll tell you what, he is all in keeping the puck out of his net, and he's still giving you 2-3 points every night. He had 14 points in the series. In a 7-game series, he had 14 points and was impeccable defensively. So this guy's made turn the corner, right? He's we all watched Yzerman do it, and we watched Crosby do it, and we're watching McDavid do it now. He's a full 200-foot player here. And, you know, the argument of who's the best player in the league, like, I know it hasn't been around for a while, but you can bury that sucker 6 feet under. There isn't a guy in the league. Now that he's playing both ends, there isn't a guy in the league that could carry Connor McDavid's equipment bag, my friend.
Whenever the season ends for the Edmonton Oilers, whether it be a loss to the Calgary Flames or maybe a Stanley Cup win, is there a significant contract offer on the table for Evander Kane?
I don't think they'll be able to afford Evander Kane, you guys. I mean, he's, you know, his numbers during the regular season, if you, you know, prorate him, he's basically a 40-goal, 90-point guy. So what's that guy make? You know, is he a $7.5 million player?
Probably.
I don't know. Evander Kane, I feel like there's special circumstances there where he might be forced to give a discount.
There is. I think there's no doubt. We all, you know, we don't need to go too deep into that. I've certainly gone into it my toppy over the months. But I will say this to you. I would suggest, guys, that where he'll have to sacrifice because of his off-ice reputation will be in term. I suspect he probably won't have to sacrifice that much in money. So he's not getting 7x7 the way he got from San Jose, but I'll tell you what, he might get 3 or 4x7.5 from someone. He might get a shorter term deal because of his financial situation, which is widely reported. There's no hometown discounts coming here from this guy, and I wouldn't expect them to do so. You know, he's going to max out salary wise because he needs to do that. And I just don't think Edmonton has the cap space to fit that player in. And he's, you know what, listen, again, I was, you know, I gave that signing the stink eye as hard as anybody when the Oilers made it in March or February. And I got all the history. It's all written down. I get it. But if you strip that part away and you look at the guy that steps onto the sheet ice and you put all that other stuff away for a second here, he is a fantastic hockey player, man. He can score. He can pass. He can hit. He can fight.
Yeah.
Right?
He's a great player. No one, there's never been a debate on that.
He's a five-tool player down there. But he's got the baggage. But you know what? You guys watch professional sports. Does baggage really ever make a guy not get a contract offer? I'm not so sure that it does.
Speck, this was great, man. Thanks a lot for doing this today. We really appreciate it. It's going to be a fun series for sure. Enjoy it. Let's do this again real soon, maybe midway through the series.
All right, boys, you got my number.
Thanks. Appreciate it. That's Mark Spector from Sportsnet, author of the Battle of Alberta book. A reminder that game one between Edmonton and Calgary is in Calgary. It goes Wednesday, 6:30 our time. 6:30 on Wednesday.
So the Halford and Brough poll question, who are you cheering for in the Battle of Alberta? Three options, the Flames, Oilers, or I Refuse to Answer. Mm-hmm. Congratulations to I Refuse to Answer, which is currently leading the poll with 40%. Flames have 38% compared to the Oilers at 22%.
These results are what I kind of expected. Majority of the people punting, those that didn't punt, I could see just based on the fact of how many former Canucks are employed there, people would be like, well, if I got to pick one, I'll pick Calgary. It's an easy tick on the old box there just because there's so many familiar faces.
Do you think the younger folks might be more apt to vote for Calgary because they don't have that history with the Flames?
Sure. That's a totally valid.
Like 2014-15, I know they played, but that wasn't like...
I don't think that one's hanging long in the memory of the youths.
No, but they're, for people our age, middle age... there's 89, there's 94, there's 2004.
Yep.
And there's just, it's funny. It was almost like back in the day, the Oilers were just too good to be a rival. Do you know what I mean? But the Flames were also really good, but they were somehow during the playoffs, especially at the Canucks level, like 1989, the Flames went on to win the Stanley Cup. But nobody gave them a tougher series that year than the Vancouver Canucks.
Rivalries are made in the postseason because there need to be stakes involved. And unfortunately for the Canucks and Oilers in the 80s and 90s, there were no stakes because Edmonton was just better. You're not going through the annals of Edmonton Oilers history and remembering all those hurdles they had to overcome in Vancouver. It's just a blip. Calgary and Vancouver, back in our day, and even up to the 2004 series, Marty Gelinas, the Eliminator and all that, those were tightly contested affairs with a lot on the line. So that's where you get the disconnect between the two rivalries. I've said this three times now, so I feel like I'm repeating myself, but I am right now, the theater of it, literally, like going to a movie, like this is going to be entertainment value. I am going to be fascinated over the first two games of the series to see how they officiate it. Really am, because I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but the whistles have not gone away at all. We've seen overtimes end on power plays. We saw a game seven yesterday end on a power play goal. Game seven overtime power play goal. Artemi Panarin with the Rangers. You just don't see that very often. You know, the notion of putting the whistles away altogether, game seven playoffs, like you have to murder someone to go to the box, not the case.
Tampa Bay, Boston in 2011?
No penalties.
None.
The entire game. Like, you know what? Hudson Bay rules, we're going to throw the whistles out. It's different now. And I don't know what the message is going to be going into that series. I think the guy...
There's no way this series isn't going to have some fireworks because... even though it's not the 1980s anymore and there's no Dave Semenko or Tim Hunter or, you know, there's a ton of players you could mention. They're going to be influenced by the crowd. They're going to be influenced by just the rivalry that is expected to happen. It happens. That's what happens. Like, even if it's not the game plan, it's going to happen that way because the crowd will expect it and there will be that energy. And I can't wait for it.
So here's the thing. And Speck brought up a really good point here. You know exactly what Tkachuk's going to do in this series, right? Laddie is a goalie. You know that every time Smith makes a save, he's going to be millimeters away from him, hunched over him, breathing on him, maybe a little bit of snow shower if he can get it in there, just anything he can do to get in his kitchen. And then it's going to be, well, I got to clear the front of the net. I got to get this guy out of here. That leads to a scrum. If you let the scrums play out, you run the risk of, well, one of these is going to boil over and we're going to have a Donnybrook, a Pier 6, a line brawl. If you start plucking guys, you know what's going to happen is that Tkachuk's going to be the instigator. And who's the guy that often gets penalized? It's the retaliator. And you don't want that because you don't want Tkachuk saying, well, I can stand over Smith all day.
Yeah.
As soon as Cassian punches me in the head, I'm going to go down and we're going to go on the power play.
Might be Mike Smith with a blocker.
Yeah, sure. Right. Take your pick. But yeah. Someone's getting punched. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic. You almost have to say, Tkachuk, what you're doing is within the rules.
Yeah.
It's also kind of a dick move. We're not going to give you guys a power play every time that someone clocks you for just hovering over a goalie.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fine, delicate dance that's going to go on in this series.
Well, the question is also, how are the referees going to call the checking on McDavid?
Right.
Are the Flames going to be able to hook and hold a little bit on McDavid? Because if they are, that's a huge advantage for the Flames. Mm-hmm. But if they aren't, that Oilers power play can really hurt you.
Well, that's the thing, right? If you start giving up countless man advantages, Draisaitl, McDavid, Nuge, Hyman, they're going to bury you.
Yeah.
That's just the inevitability of it.
McDavid is, honestly, he is just, his performance in Game 6 and 7 was...
He played 27 minutes in game
you know,
seven
like he,
as a forward.
It was almost like, you know, in Major League when Serrano goes like, F you, Joe Boo, I do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's like, that's
what he did.
That's what he's like. All right. He's like, all right, we're down 3-2 to the LA Kings. Draisaitl's hurt. I know the history of my team. Mm-hmm. I got to do this myself. And his coach, Jay Woodcroft, was kind of like, you know, you're going to do it yourself.
And everyone's congratulating Jay Woodcroft for the great coaching job where he took the best player in hockey
yeah. And
said, play the most minutes tonight.
Oh, you mean beer league strategy.
27 minutes for a forward. Like I looked
it's
at him.
Crazy.
Like, those are old school, like Ilya Kovalchuk with the New Jersey Devil numbers.
Yeah, but he didn't skate hard.
No, I know.
He was just out there.
He just take 18-minute shifts. But I'm watching this, and I'm like, he sets up CeCe for the 1-0 goal. He scores the 2-0 goal in just like an outrageous individual effort. He's all over the ice, back-checking like crazy. And, if you're Woodcroft, you're just kind of like, I got to find him more opportunities to get him on the ice. Like they did in game 6. I remember I've got the picture somewhere. He literally played with every forward in the first period.
Yeah.
I think they quintuple shifted him. He just kept throwing him back out. And you can say, well, that's not great strategy. It's just pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to be able to execute it. And you got to make sure you don't burn them out. That's another thing, too. I mean, again, 27 minutes for a forward in the Stanley Cup playoffs in Game 7, where you've already had 6, where you're going pretty hard, it's a remarkable feat. So to be able to get him to do it to maximize it, like Woodcroft does deserve some credit.
It's Alfred and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. Get your What We Learns in. We got one final segment. We have a fair number of What We Learns in the Dunbar Lumber text line, but we could always use more. So get those in. Text them in to 650-650. We'll read them on the other side. This is the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650.
Monday. Happy Monday, everybody. Let's go. We really do need to implement the Halford and Bruff dancers when this comes in. And now featuring the Halford and Bruff dancers.
Like the Ace Rothstein show? Now the Ace Rothstein dancers.
What is he, juggling?
Told you to keep a low profile.
You could have had the food and beverage job.
God, we're getting old.
Alfred Brown, Sportsnet 650. Bring it up, Quincy. This is, what's it called? For Quincy, right? name of the song. Gets me going.
What up with that sketch from Saturday Night?
What is up with that? Gets me going. It's a Monday.
That was an amazing sketch.
The theme song just goes on forever. You get into the sax solo. It's great.
Half and Breath of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. Hour three of the program brought to you by Campbell and Pound Real Estate Appraisers. Trust the expertise of Campbell and Pound. Visit Campbell-Pound.com today. This is what we learned time. The weekend just finished. So what did you learn over the last 72 hours in sports? Got a lot to get to. Who has one? Is it Laddie or is it Brock?
I'm going to do one. I learned that this week is the week of golf's second major of the season. It's at Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa. Probably my favorite, the first 48 location.
Tulsa. Little Rock, Arkansas gets a lot of love on that show, too. But yeah. Tulsa gets a lot of first 48.
I just really like to have a really depressing city
Tulsa's
to watch
there,
the first 48. At any rate, Tiger Woods expected to play. Now, he won the PGA at this golf course in 2007. And if you go to play now, you can get Tiger Woods to win this thing at 66-1. The favorites are the guys that you'd expect, and the fact that there is no heavy favorite is not unexpected either. Scottie Scheffler at 11-1, John Rahm at 12-1, Justin Thomas, Rory, Jordan Spieth, Colin Morikawa, DJ, like all these guys are going to be in the mix, expected at least by the odds makers. If Tiger Woods isn't the big story this week, it's that Phil Mickelson is not there. This is the defending PGA champion who will not be defending his championship because he wants to go play in the Saudi League, but also because I think he's just trying to avoid the spotlight in North America. If you go to ESPN.com right now, after all the NBA, after all the NHL, the main story at ESPN.com is headlined "The Stunning and Rapid Fall of Phil Mickelson in Just 1 Year." And you have to remember, a year ago, Mickelson was like a great story. For all the old guys out there, and I guess we include ourselves now, this was a guy that won a major at the age of 50. And he was riding high. And maybe this is the story of Phil's life, riding high and then not riding high.
Yeah.
If you've read a lot of the articles that have come out as a result of Alan Shipnuck's book, which is the same author that got him on the record, talking about the Saudis, he had substantial gambling losses. And there has been the big question hanging over this whole story is like, why is Phil doing this? And his explanation was like, to get better leverage on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
And other people are like, that's a weak excuse. You're going to need a better one. What if his excuse is, I just need the money, man.
I think that might
I need the money.
It's very clear that that is kind of where this is going, unless I'm wrong.
Oh, I mean, it's definitely pointing in that direction.
Like, he kind of used the cloak of, I'm fighting for justice in golf, and I don't like the PGA Tour's draconian ways.
Yeah, and but then, also Georgia Tech didn't cover.
And then I was like, wait a minute. I feel like you just need money.
Yeah.
And it's too bad because I think for as charismatic as the guy can be and with the great story that he wrote, the Fig Jam thing always resonated with me. It's like everyone knew the facade.
I thought that might have been more when he was young, though.
It didn't seem like it went away.
You know what? I think it did go away for a little bit because Phil got so badly humbled with some of his losses, like blowing it at the U.S. Open, and then people started to cheer for him to finally get over the hump.
But he was more active
on social media, and people liked what he was doing on social media. He was always considered like a generous guy, like a big tipper, and people appreciated that. And they used to compare that to Tiger Woods, who was not considered a big tipper.
Right.
And their personalities were juxtapositioned for sake of debate. At any rate, looking forward to the golf, as I always am. I don't know how much we're going to talk about it on this show with the Stanley Cup playoffs going on and maybe the Vancouver Canucks doing some stuff. But we'll see. I think if Tiger Woods can make the cut and compete, It'd be pretty compelling.
Moo Cow. I've got some. Don't play the breaking news button, but it is breaking news because it just happened in the middle of what we learned. You see, Laddie is hovering his finger over it. Please don't do it. It's news and it's noteworthy. Last week on this show, we broke the news that Barry Trotz had been fired as the head coach of the New York Islanders. Well, we get to announce the new head coach right now. It is, wait for it, drum roll please, Barry Trotz's longtime assistant, Lane Lambert. Lou Lamoriello has announced that Lane Lambert is the new head coach of the New York Islanders. He said he has had the opportunity to work with Lane extensively over the last 4 years, including a stint where he was the interim head coach when Barry Trotz took a leave from the team. Lamoriello then added, in my opinion, he is the right person to coach this team.
Do you think his hair got him over the top in this case?
He's got good hair.
He's got amazing hair.
He's got good hair.
That's the one thing that I know about Lane Lambert. And even the name Lane sounds like you've got a good, well, mane, I guess.
Lane has good mane.
Yeah.
That's very well put.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about it in those contexts, in those terms. What I was thinking about was he's been the next head coach in waiting for a long time. I think that he's been shortlisted for a bunch of different gigs. I do wonder if Lamoriello thought, if I don't give him the job, we're going to lose him. And I see him being the head coach, maybe not this year, maybe down the road. And then he thought, you know what? If I'm going to make the change at some point in anyway, why not just make it now?
You know what's always interesting is when these longtime assistants for Barry Trotz or longtime assistants for anyone get the gig, it's how much are they similar to the guy that they coached under?
You know what it always reminds
me of? But also, how are they different?
You know what it always reminds
Sully?
Me of? No, actually, I'll go to
Sullivan under Torts.
When Washington went from George McPhee to Brian McClellan as general manager after all their playoff failures. Mm-hmm. I know it's different, the head coaching and GM, but I remember the knock was, this is a really uninspiring hire as your general manager because McClellan was the assistant under McPhee and he was in lockstep building this team that always fell short in the playoffs. And then they went out and won a Stanley Cup when he thought their window was closed.
Right.
And
Didn't someone speak out really aggressively against Brian McClellan?
Everybody did. They're like, this is your big shakeup? Is you're going to promote your assistant GM to GM? Because, I mean, remember, when they kept losing to Pittsburgh, it was, you got to change the entire trajectory of this team. You got to trade Ovechkin. You got to restart. You'll never win with this group. And then McClellan comes in. Everyone's like, he's too closely tied to the previous regime. But it worked. Now, I don't know if the same situation is going to apply here. You brought up the Sullivan one as well, right? Like we had what we thought was an understanding of what Sullivan was as a coach, as Torts' right-hand man.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the aftermath, he's proven to be much more than what we thought.
He's such a good coach.
Yeah, and you know what? You know, J.D. Bunkus was on the show earlier, and he talked about the sport is a sport of relationships. Hockey,
yeah.
And it really is. You often are considered like a team, and you know, tag team or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when these guys do get to step out and forge their own path, I think they're very cognizant of making it their own.
We already mentioned this on the show, but speaking of relationships, now that the Penguins are out, and now that we might see kind of an era coming to an end in Pittsburgh, I wonder if there's going to be any more additions from Pittsburgh to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about maybe the training staff, strength and conditioning. Yeah. The Canucks have to hire all new guys.
Get a couple of exercise bikes in from Cranberry.
I honestly wonder, right? Because the Pittsburgh Penguins are in a situation where they've got new ownership. They've got key guys like Malkin, Letang, Brian Rust. I think even like Evan Rodriguez is a pending unrestricted free agent.
Mm-hmm.
They need to restock the organization in terms of prospects. I realize they've still got Sidney Crosby under contract there, which might complicate things a little bit. But Sid's getting on a little bit. And I think it'll just going to be interesting because you got all these guys that – and some people, like they don't love when guys just bring over other people from the organization.
Sure.
Because I think they'd like them to kind of spread their wings and see what else is out there, right? But if you've got something that works, a process that works, or at least you think that works, and the Penguins won 2 Stanley Cups, so they probably had a decent process.
Uh-huh.
Why not bring the same guys over?
trust is a big thing. You got it. There's probably
like you don't have to explain the process. You're just like, this is what we do, right, guys? All right,
and everyone just gets to work.
And you know that okay, this guy, I can trust this guy. I don't have to micromanage this person, right? Mm-hmm. And this person is going to get the job done. Let's dip more into the Dunbar Lumber text line. So Lane Lambert will be the new head coach of the New York Islanders.
I Dempster have one ready Dan, if you need.
I got tons. Dempster Dan, what we learned, out of all the second-round series, the New York Rangers-Carolina series has the least amount of interest to me.
That's fair.
Fair enough, yeah. That's fair. I mean, the other ones are the Battle of Florida.
This is going to be good.
Yeah, we'll see. Florida and Tampa Bay.
If it's anything like last year's series, it's going to be
good. Yeah. And then you've got Colorado and St. Louis, and just watching Colorado is fun, and I think St. Louis is coming in feeling pretty good about their game. And then, of course, you got the Battle of Alberta. Minor Matt in Abbotsford. What we learned, I learned from last night's Stars versus Flames overtime that I feel old. It was only three quarters of an extra period, and I feel like trash from getting less than 6 hours of sleep. I watched it in bed.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I stayed up. I was buckled in for seven overtimes the way it was going.
Kind of felt like that, didn't it?
I was actually a little shocked that they found a way to beat Ottinger on that chance, which apparently, are really people blaming him, Laddie?
Yeah. I have people in my mentions asking if he could have played it differently. Which he could have, but
I think I felt like he got stunned by the first shot. Didn't it hit him up high? I think it did. He almost felt like he got rocked back in his net a little bit. And then, oh, it's right on the TV right now. Perfect timing. And then Gaudreau didn't really look at where he was shooting. He just fired high.
Oh, he admitted after the game, he just shot it looking for the net. But that's a play that you practice as a shooter from that spot over
it's
and over
instinct.
And over. Yeah. And he picked it perfectly.
Speaking of Ottinger, from Rager, what we learned, if Ottinger is the next great young American goaltender, then Canada really is in trouble. So I did the list right now.
They got like 10 guys.
Demko, Hellebuck, Gibson, Ottinger just shot himself into that conversation.
You can still argue Jonathan Quick after
Jonathan
this playoff.
Jonathan Quick had an amazing playoffs.
Who have we got in Canada?
Carter Hart.
Jordan Binnington. He's back, baby. Binnington's back.
A healthy price, perhaps.
I mean,
are those the options,
those
right?
Those are the options.
Binnington, Carter Hart, and Carey Price. Maybe it was good we
Mark
didn't
Andre
have the Olympics this year.
Marc-Andre Fleury.
Come on, man. Like this, I think
at least Fleury played this year. Yeah. Price didn't even play this year.
But bringing up those guys just shows you the lack of really elite Canadian goaltenders out there right now.
Okay.
We're talking about Fleury and Carey Price, who have been in the Olympic discussion going way back.
Well, when did they lift the Euro ban for goalies in the CHL? Not that long ago.
Like
4 years ago, I want to say?
I was
3 years ago?
There was a ban.
There was a ban on European goaltenders, but it was so poor, the quality, that they had to reinstate the Euro goalies. So that tells you about the state of Canadian goaltending, I think, right there.
Oh, there are too many goals being scored? What, the games were too exciting? We need to lock it down again.
Darcy Kemper? I'm still pulling names here. Mike Smith?
Just give it a rest.
It's not great.
Mike Smith for the Olympics.
Nathan, with a what we learned. Nathan sounds like a very hard man to impress.
Okay.
Here's his what we learned. McDavid has a couple amazing games against a team that was barely a playoff team, and he's the greatest playoff performer in the league. Hey, maybe he is, but I'll wait until he can do that to a real contender. Who called him the greatest playoff performer in the league? We just said that he had an amazing couple of games. Did Speck call him the pretty sure Speck didn't say that about him.
That's a take. That is, what's the guy's name again? The text of the
Nathan.
Sin? Nathan.
That is the classic straw man.
I guess.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say. I didn't think that I would have someone text in being unimpressed with Connor McDavid on the
weekend.
Is
that comic book guy?
It's unbelievable. He played.
Maybe do it against a good team.
Yeah. In the second round. He couldn't have done anything more. Let's put it that way. He played 27 minutes. He set up the first goal. He scored the second goal. Might have made a couple saves. I don't know. I know Smith made 29. Maybe McDavid got a couple blocks in there.
Chayton and Surrey, what we learned, this is for Laddie. I learned the Pittsburgh Pirates beat the awful Cincinnati Reds 1-0 without registering a single hit.
How did this happen?
All game. Yeah, the Cincinnati Reds found a new way to lose. It was getting a no-hitter, and they still lost 1-0.
But they didn't commit any errors either.
No, it was a couple walks, a ground out, and then an RBI ground out.
Oh, well, RBI ground out. Okay.
That was the only run of the entire game.
Do you think
game.
That's the most exciting play in baseball, the RBI ground out?
It's up there with the sack fly.
Yeah.
It's up there.
Love a good sack fly with no play at the plate.
Glenn in Richmond also texted that one in. I learned the Reds are so bad. They threw a no-hitter and still lost. I want to read a CFL one.
Oh, right. Strike.
But I didn't want to beat up on the CFL because they're like, Bruff's always beating up on the CFL, so I'll let Tyler do it. What we learned, someone needs to tell the CFL players and the CFL commissioner that they have missed an entire season and they had a partial season last year. Figure your out and get a deal struck. You can't miss another season or the CFL will be done. I don't think the CFL is going to miss a season just because they're on strike, but it's not a good look. Like, you should, this should be all about hype for the season. And once again, they're in, you know, labor negotiations, which is the last thing that fans want to see. They'll figure this out, guys. Like, I'm not worried. Like, we're not going to have a season. They're going to have a season. But, yeah, it's not a good look. The CFL needs to... CFL needs so much. One of those things is not a strike.
No.
Or debates about, like...
No stoppage. No work stoppage.
Yeah, it's almost...
You can't afford it.
Yeah, it's almost like it's insane that this is happening. That being said... When there are industries that are struggling, you're more likely to have these labor issues because the pie is smaller. Like, there's less money to go around. Mm-hmm. The players are saying, we're not getting paid enough. And you're kind of look at the average salary of like the guys in the CFL, and you're like, yeah, I guess. And the owners are going to be like, are the players crazy? Like, do you know what we've been through in the last little while? Like, we need to make some money here. And you kind of agree with them. When industries are in trouble, that's when the labor issues really rise to the front. It's kind of cruel that it's happening to the CFL, but not altogether surprising.
This is a What We Learned and an Ask Us Anything. Are you guys going to have anyone from the Canadian men's national soccer team on the show since a pair of upcoming games are in Vancouver? So, yeah, June 5th and June 9th, it's the friendly versus Iran, and then it's the CONCACAF Nations League against Curaçao. I'll say this, and shout out to Dom. He has tried in vain to work with Canada Soccer. Let's just say they are not the most reciprocal when it comes to interest. I will leave it at that. But we are efforting. We are trying. We know the significance of these games. I saw the tickets for the Iran match. I just said Iran.
Iran match.
You're going to the Iran match next week.
You just don't want to sound like an American and be like,
Iran.
Canada's going to play Iran.
Iran so far away. It's like Flock of Seagulls. I understand how many people are interested in the Canadian men's national team. Those tickets are selling like crazy. I managed to get them for both.
Colin and Tawasin with a What We Learned. Vancouver is all behind Canada soccer, even though we only get the meaningless games. I was looking at getting tickets to the Iran game for my son and I, and none are available in the lower bowl. Yeah, I looked at this over the weekend too. I'm going to go, but I don't have tickets, and I guess I'm going to be sitting in the upper deck unless I don't know, get some freebies or pay big to be in the lower bowl.
I don't know what the secondary market's going to look like. I know that a lot of supporters groups and individual teams, including the Whitecaps, their season ticket holders got first bite at this. And then I would imagine that's why. I think the report was the 27K, which is essentially the lower bowl, sold out within hours. Like, it was just all snapped up.
It was all gone, yeah.
Yeah, so...
And I think there's an Iranian supporter section, too.
Right, there's all...
And there is an Iranian community in Vancouver. A lot of them are over on the North Shore, and I expect a lot of them to be at the game. Will they be in the Iranian supporter section, or will they be cheering for Canada? I have no idea.
Well, but
I'm curious to see what the environment's going to be like.
The larger point is that a lot of these supporters group got pre-sales ate up the tickets right away. So we haven't even really had the general public part of it yet. I'm sure that'll come. That's why I'm wondering about the secondary market.
I'm a little surprised at the interest for this game. I have to be honest. Like, and I'm impressed because, I thought Canada would in Vancouver. Canada would have played a qualifying game at BC Place, it would have been sold out.
Mm-hmm.
But I did wonder, just a friendly, right?
Well, I'll push back a little bit. It is another team that's going to the World Cup.
I know.
The intrigue around Iran, obviously.
I know they're good.
No, but the intrigue around them is who they're drawn into a group with, right? It's England and the U.S. So they become a very, very intriguing opponent. Obviously, the Iranian community is very large here. I would also add... we're months away from this. Like, the World Cup starts in November. Like, so it is a tune-up, but those are important matches.
Do you know what kind of a fun day that could be? Maybe it might actually not even be raining in Vancouver in June. It's a 4 o'clock start on a Sunday, so you can go downtown beforehand, maybe grab some lunch, enjoy the atmosphere. I will definitely be there. I might be sitting at the top of BC Place, though.
I'm going to be there, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
The Canada jacket is coming back out.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, that'll be great. It's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to it. It's only a couple weeks away. Coming up next, it's the Jeff Merrick Show. We got to get out of here for now, but we will be back tomorrow. Signing off, I have been Mike Halford. He's been Jason Brough, and he's been Laddie. This has been the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.